old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. A bit grey today, isn't it?
I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Deepest Lore. And this is the very first show, coming to you live from AA Lodge. Yes, I am sitting in the lodge. I slept in the lodge last night. I had a very long sleep. I slept for 13 hours. You have 13 hours in which to solve the labyrinth before your baby brother becomes one of us forever. Such a pity. Yes, there is a brand new schedule, ladies and gentlemen. So let me drill it into your minds, okay? Monday afternoon, 3 p.m., Deepest Lore. Tuesday, 9 p.m., Unpopular Opinions, hasn't changed. Wednesday, 9 p.m., Cigar Stream. That is the schedule for the week. And then what I will do is I'll line up my videos for the week to come out, you know, over the weekend or whatever, okay? So you'll have a bank of three days. Then you've got the rest of the week to catch up on those shows and also to catch any videos I decide to make. All right. So that's it. Somebody's saying 3 p.m. my ass. Let me just tell you something, sunshine. Okay. Let me just tell you something, Piero, PhD. What's your PhD in, son? What's your PhD in? How long did you study for? Come on. Out with it. yeah, you're right. I was a little bit late today. I happened to have to go like foraging for berries. I didn't realize I had no coffee here. I had no tea here. So I needed to go and get coffee and tea. So I got lost and ended up in a village. I had to reverse about half a mile, because there was this tractor coming the other way. So, you know, getting a little bit used to some of the country rural life here. So I got lost by going the wrong way. And then I had to like sat nav it all the way back to the lodge and then start out again, looking to buy some coffee. And I ended up at an Aldi. Oh my God. If you've ever seen an Aldi, ladies and gentlemen, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I sent out a tweet about my experiences. I said, I'm in Aldi. There are giant troughs haphazardly stacked with matter down the middle of the aisle, as if the management have decided proper shelving is too good for you people. Honestly, there's something misanthropic about Aldi. All of the kind of people scuttling, like, I don't know, they're treated like pigs and then they behave like pigs. I find it really interesting. So that's probably the last time I'm going to be visiting an Aldi. I need to locate a higher caliber of store, one that does not treat people with such disdain. Although I admire their honesty, I admire them telling the cattle, you are little more than pigs, you know, you are little more than creatures to be treated in this manner. I've never seen anything like it. There are these, like, they don't have proper shelves. It's just like crates stacked with stuff. And it's just like, here's some coffee, Peppa Pig toy, bloody, here are some books, here's some cleaning product. And there's just no rhyme or reason to it. It's just like stuff. And they don't even like, in some of them, they're all just like jumbled up. So you have to kind of go rummaging through it, looking for, you know, random things. It's it really is something bizarre. I just don't get it. People are saying that's why it's cheap. Indeed. Offa, you're gonna like this stream, son. because it's all about this dream is all about the chosen people, as it were. Because, well, I've been listening to a chap called Thomas Biden Rees, who he had a couple of run-ins with him. He's made a couple of videos where he tried to have a go at me, and then he made a video having a go at Poe, the person who he hates, and then various other things. But anyway, he does these streams where he kind of assesses and looks at dozens of people. He did one on nationalists, you know, talking about people in the nationalist scene. He did one on like YouTubers where he looked at many different people. He looked at like the fake right, where he had a lengthy critique of the British show and D and various other people. He hates Ed Dutton. But there's something about Thomas Biden Rees that I kind of like. I kind of dig his, I don't know, I feel like I understand him instinctually. Now, there are some odd elements of Thomas Biden Rees, like his compulsive lying, for example, which I'm not sure how to take that. He's like an open liar, and I don't really get that. But anyway, he did a stream recently on Spiked with Horus and with Nick Unwashed. This is the other weird thing about the Thomas Biden Rees streams. Unwashed is sensible on those streams. I mean, you will all know Unwashed from my women's question stream that I did with him, and for simping for various unsavory women. Unwashed seems like perfectly sensible on those streams. Well, anyway, I was listening to this Thomas Biden Rees character. Somebody say he's like the type of character I give a wide berth to in real life. Yeah. Yeah, you would. But there's something about him that I've been really enjoying these streams that he does, right? So apparently it's Baden Rees, not Biden. Okay, fair enough. So anyway, hold on a minute. He was going through like the various people who write for Unwashed, and one of the people was Julie Burchill, who wrote this book called Unchosen. Okay, and the subtitle of the book is The Memoirs of a Philo-Semite. Okay, now I don't know what this book says, but the very idea of it itself intrigues me. Okay, intrigues me. So today we're going to be reading out bits of Unchosen by Julie Burchill and maybe critiquing some of it on the fly. But I'm interested as to how this could even come about. Just the idea of it in itself is fascinating. And we're going to analyze the front cover. We're going to analyze, we're going to ask, why was this book published? We're going to analyze some of the blurb on the back of the book. It is something to behold, I tell you. Okay. Now, also, I'm still doing my fasting. I haven't eaten, friends, since 7 p.m. last night. And my window for eating doesn't open until 5. So all I've had is a Nescafe Gold to eat today. So that's how I'm rolling. What else? Yes, I would stick around for this stream. I think you'd enjoy this one. As you should offer if you're still here. I think anybody interested in this particular issue should stick around, because I think it's whichever side of the aisle you're on, it's a fascinating document that this exists. Okay. Before I get going here, first of all, thanks a lot to D for his 8-part Andy Warhol series. It was almost like a kind of residency that that D had on the Deepest Lore from July until November. And it's like when a poet in residence has like finished their term. Now I'm like, what do I fill the Deepest Lore with now? Pharaoh had Pharaoh has. Yeah, unfortunately, Poe, I don't have sugar. I forgot to buy sugar in Aldi. So this is unsugared coffee, unfortunately. There we go. Yes, it's unfair. It's unfair. But no sugar. No sugar! Did I ever tell you that I had a idea of a series of adverts for Pepsi Max where the setup was, you can imagine like a romantic couple in a restaurant, you know, like Poe and Mr. Poe, for example, in a restaurant. You know, I don't know, like Mr. Poe goes to order a Pepsi, for example, and essentially the setup would be that a kind of genie character, or an Indian, it could be an Indian chap. I had in mind the one from Seinfeld who goes, no. Could be an Indian chap, or it could be a genie. I haven't quite decided, but kind of definitively ethnically Eastern, like from Asia, they should be, okay? And basically, they come from under the table, or they rush in, and they interrupt the couple, and he would just go in Mr. Poe's face, no sugar! Like that. A bit like the old Tango adverts where the Tango man would, you know, get in somebody's face, no sugar! And then, you know, Pepsi, the setup is to avoid having the sugar, you have the Pepsi Max, okay? And then there'd be a series of these adverts. So like in the second advert, for example, the couple, let's say it's Poe and Mr. Poe, would be, let's say on one of those big wheels, you know, like the Millennium Eye, for example. They'd be on the Millennium Eye, and you know, I don't know, Mr. Poe would say to Poe, have you got a Pepsi in your bag, and she'd got to get it. And then somehow, as if by magic, this figure, whether he's the Indian or the genie or whatever, would emerge even within the bubble of the thing, and he'd be like, "No sugar." And that was the whole series of adverts that I had planned. That was my second great advert series that never got made. My first series was the retiring the Big Mac saga that I had. But the second one was my no sugar advert. And then I noticed that, I don't know if Pepsi Max advertisers took notice of my ravings, but as if by magic, a couple of months later, Pepsi Max did start running massive billboards in London with just the words no sugar on it. It's just like Pepsi Max, no sugar, like that. So, I mean, clearly something was in the ether there. I haven't put Entropy live. Thanks for reminding me, Yiz. I always forget. Now, how is my sound, folks? This is the first time I'm coming from the lodge. What do we think? Sound good? Does it sound good? Can you even notice if you didn't know that I was in a different place? Would you know I'm not? One thing I don't have is the threat of AAA coming in at any moment. Although apparently she has been missing her daddy, so you know I'm gonna have to go home soon. Probably cigar stream this week will be from home, not from the lodge, because I don't want to spend too much time away at this moment. Especially because I'm the one who typically puts AAA to bed. Oh, hold on. Have I got any work done yet? No. I've literally spent most of the day ineffectually driving around looking to buy some coffee and then forgetting to buy sugar. That's literally my day so far. So now I'm here. So somebody says I sound lonely. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, this is the story of my life. I continuously look for the kind of amazing space where I'm totally alone, and then as soon as I get there, I freak out. That's basically what happens. So anyway, Yes, that's literally. What's the other thing? The other thing I do is that I'm perpetually looking for that amazing rainy day where you get to play all your video games and all the Steam games. But when the rainy day comes, I can't decide what to do. So if I ever get that amazing rainy day where there's nothing to do, do you think I play the Steam games? No. No, I'll probably look through them and then can't be bothered to play any of them. So, yes, the panaceas of being truly alone and having the rainy day that never comes, if they ever finally arrive, I always freak out and never. I mean, I remember once I was I don't know if you remember, a few years ago there were massive floods, and I was living in an area that really flooded badly. It was February, and it was flooded so badly that I couldn't get to work. I had to write in and say, like, look, I'm surrounded by water here. I'm not sure what to do. My car was stuck and all the rest of it. And I finally had it. I finally had the situation where I had the rainy day that never came. I had a bank of literally a week where I was stuck in the. And it was, I don't think it was past the second day where I was crawling up the walls. I had cabin fever. I had to get out. I bought plastic bags. I put plastic bags on my feet to walk through the water. I called work and said, listen, fuck it, I'm going to come in anyway. Just sod it. I'm going to catch the train. I've put plastic bags on my feet. I'll catch the train. So basically, I am, when it comes to my own kind of my own notions of what I truly want, I'm profoundly confused or fraudulent in my own mind. Because if I ever get the things I want, I can't, you know, I don't really want them. So there we go. yes. There we go. Yes. Shall we start our look at, shall I start my look at, Poe, are you, I can't believe Poe is already trying to, pause my Pepsi Max advert saying it should be a mixed race couple. No, don't make it a mixed race couple. Okay. So let me have a look. I'm not rambling, Gulandia. Rambling is where you lose the thread of an argument. Rambling is when you don't know what you're saying or you don't know where you're going. I know exactly where I'm going and what I'm saying. So don't accuse me of rambling. Thank you very much. Next time, Galinda, you can get out. Go and watch some lesser channel if you think I'm rambling. I'm not rambling. So anyway, let me have a look at Unchosen by Julie Birchall then. So the first thing I want to do here is I want to analyze the front cover of this book, because this is a book about how Julie Birchall wishes that she had been born Jewish. And the quote by Tanya Gold, and I don't know who Tanya Gold is. I will have a look up Tanya Gold, just to see if she is chosen, so to speak. Let's have a look. Tanya Gold is a journalist. She writes for The Guardian, Daily Mail, The Independent, The Telegraph, The Sunday Times, The Evening Standard, The Spectator. But I don't know, doesn't have a section on her biography, sadly. She is on Twitter, though. So can we, if I was to guess looking at Tanya Gold, I would say that Tanya Gold is Jewish. Okay. So that would make sense, I think, for Tanya Gold to be, you know, I think it would make sense for the person to write the blurb on the front of this book to be chosen as opposed to unchosen. Okay. And she says, Julie Birchall has the most chronic case of Jew madness on record. Incurable, irrational, and very funny. I love this book. And the book depicts Julie Birchall herself as a clown, as an unhappy clown, sitting in the middle of members of this group. Now, before we even get going here, how does this book even come about? I don't really understand. Like, what is the premise? What is the premise of this book? Like, and why has Julie Birchall agreed for herself to be depicted in this manner? And now it's being like held up by, now it's being held up as this amazing thing by members of the chosen group. I find that, really bizarre. Anyway, let's carry on. Here's the back cover. Okay. They say you never got over your first love, and in my case, they were right. But typically greedy, my first love was a whole race of people, the Jews. In February 2013, Julie Birchall, the country's most controversial journalist for four decades. Now, is that true? Is it true that Julie Birchall is the country's most controversial journalist? Really? Julie Birchall? You know, she's a leftist for one thing. So that's bollocks, isn't it, Julie? Who else has become more controversial than Julie Birchall? Like, literally anyone? Rod Little, Peter Hitchens, James Dellingpole. Easily more controversial than Julie Birchall, I would suggest. But anyway, let's continue. Julie Birchall, the country's most controversial journalist for four decades, became the first person to choose Hatavika, the Israeli national anthem, on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs. Now, for the first time, she tells the full story of her philo-Semitism and how a chance discovery of her father's copy of The World at War magazine issue on the Holocaust changed her life and kindled an obsessive love that still sustains her. Over 10 no-holds-barred chapters, the book details the course of this affair, from her days as a rock journalist pretending to be Jewish to her attempts to learn Hebrew and eventual exile from her local synagogue for being too pro-Israeli. I mean, what the fuck? This is just... This is really bizarre. Can anybody explain to me? I mean, Ophir, you're here. You are Israeli, right? Explain to me what the hell's going on here. How has it happened that this Julie Birchall is so in love with another group of people that she's literally pretending to be one of them? Why is she being thrown out of a synagogue for being too? This is really, really bizarre. And not only bizarre, published by a major press. This is came out with Random House, one of the biggest presses in the world, and being openly celebrated by other members of the establishment and herself. There she is, look, literally a clown, and this is being celebrated. I just find this fascinating. Unchosen is not a book for anyone who wants a balanced account of modern Jewish culture. It's part love letter, part howl of rage at the returning specter of anti-Semitism. By her own admission, this is the subject that matters the most to her, and Unchosen is the most difficult, most important book she's ever written. 15 quid. 55-year-old journalist, Julie Birchall. She's married and lives in Brighton. So, yeah, very interesting indeed. She's written other books too. She's written fiction, she's written non-fiction. And then these are the chapters. So maybe I think what we'll do is I'll do a quick kind of poll. Which chapter should we have a look at first? A short history of philo-Semitism, finding out hip young Hebrew gunslinger or meet the perverts? What should we do? People want chapter 3, hip young Hebrew gunslinger. I think 3 has it. Meet the perverts, Hood wants. People want chapter 14. What's that? There is no chapter 14. I think 3 has it, to be honest. So let's have a little look at chapter 3 here. And I will pause to comment on this book. So that it is truly an act of cultural commentary and not just reading the book out. Let's see if I can find it a minute. I mean, really is strange how, and then very interesting is that she writes for Spiked as well. So that tells you a lot about Spiked and what they are about. Let's have a look. Okay, so that's the bit about that chapter in itself. Looked interesting, didn't it? Unchosen. So, chapter 3. Hip young Hebrew gunslinger. Be yourself. Write about what you know. From the cradle to the grave, the homespun homilies of honesty are thrust upon one like a jar of pot pourri, masquerading as a fragrant bouquet, all dusty and redundant, yet hopeful of being passed off as an original and inspiring gift that one should go into a regular swoon upon receiving. Well, I mean, that mantra there is pure boomer truth. I should mention that whole. I mean, they do tell writers to write about what you know, because otherwise they tend to write like fantasy nonsense. So there is some truth to that as a writer, but the whole be yourself thing is pure boomer truth, I would suggest. Anyway, let's. People want me to make the text bigger. That's as big as I can get it. All right. Can I get it bigger here? There you go. How's that? How's that, friends? But yeah, pure boomer truth so far. But what if you didn't know who you were? Apart from the self-defiling teen dream, you're gonna get it tonight. I would often growl at my gorgeous naked self. Oh, by the way, we should probably look at Julie Burchill, like what she looks like, so you have an image of her here. Because if I'm correct in thinking, she's kind of known for being a bit frumpy, I think. Let's have a look. This is Julie Burchill, okay? Here she is. So you've probably seen her. Like she's often a rent-a-gob on, you know, mainstream media, and she writes for all sorts of people. So there we go. There is Julie Burchill, who is so pro-Jewish that she has pretended to be. She's written this book. Okay, so let us carry on. I really do find this a fascinating topic as to how, because to be thrown out of a synagogue for being too pro-Israeli is really, really something. Hopefully you can see this. People are saying she's a Joe Brand lookalike. Okay, where are we? I would often growl at my gorgeous naked self of a morning as I pulled on my vile school uniform, following a wide-eyed pout and a finger pointing at my shimmering sternum. Who, me? I'd pipe up tremendously. Yes, I was weird. suffering from a chronic case of inappropriate ethnic identification with a people of whom I'd never even come within a sniffing distance. And how could I, how could you write about what you knew if you didn't know anything that you had to get out of the place that you were condemned to live in? No disrespect to my sainted parents. I read a line in an essay by the great David Sereidis recently about his sister Gretchen, and it really spoke to me, complete with jazz hands. See, I find this fascinating because Julie Birchall is somebody who feels like a foreigner in her own country because she wants to be, she literally feels so culturally Jewish that she wants to become Jewish. And I think there's something in this that we can learn from, friends. I think there's something interesting in it. But anyway, let's carry on. She said, "It was like having a foreign exchange student living in our house. Nothing we said or did made any sense to her, as she seemed to follow the rules and customs of some exotic, faraway nation." It's very interesting how this has come to pass. The Jews had become a symbol to me of escape, of outsiderness, not just embraced, but made magnificent. Now, when I went to the library, I wasn't looking up sex things in an encyclopedia. I was looking about stuff about Israel. Right from the beginning, I shied away from the Shoah. I didn't want to know about them being heard. I wanted to understand how they came to be strong. My blind, uncritical love of Israel, which accepted and indeed accepts to this day, without question, every last thing it does, could be seen. I mean, oh, fucking hell. I mean, it's hard to know whether this is satire or real, right? Is this real? But this is like celebrated in the main. This is fucking. She is dressed as a clown on the front of the book. Let's just carry on. My blind, uncritical love of Israel, which accepted and indeed accepts to this day, without question, every last thing it does, could be seen by an unfriendly type who more than likely has the hots for the opposite team so they can talk, as the way a maths obsessive. Now, can I just say something there? There is no, what opposite team? This notion that to be critical of one thing, you have to be pro the other thing is not true. I don't care about Palestine. Never have done, never will do. I mean, on that issue, which I don't talk about much on this channel, my view has always been like, yeah, we don't care. We just shouldn't care either way. That, it seems to me, is a position that is not allowed in the media. The media will always frame us as being pro one side or pro the other side. Like, indifference is not an option in the mainstream. So anyway, let's carry on. The way a maths obsessive delights in ultimate extreme algebra puzzle. It wasn't a crush like you'd have a pop star pinup. It was something you could look at forever trying to work out, but knowing that you wouldn't actually be missing out on any aspect of it if you never had made any headway whatsoever on getting to the root of it. Because just looking is so wonderful. To this day, I'm the only person I know whose reaction to any result in an Israeli election is, "We won," whether the first prize scoop was by left, right, and or center. I mean, fucking hell. Just the thought of Jews voting for other Jews strikes me as the most immensely wonderful thing. I'm almost... This is really, really strange. I mean, can anybody in the chat tell me that they think this is not unusual, this book? This is fucking mental. Hold on a minute. You're going to have to give me a second, folks, because I still have this bloody cold. I just have to get some loo roll a minute so I don't sniff all the way through the stream. I mean, 1 second, you can carry on looking at this book. All right, sorry, I'm now back. One thing to mention very, very quickly about the bizarreness of this book is that everybody in the chat saying, "Well, she's mental. She's actually insane." But this woman is not mental or insane, or indeed an outsider in the British establishment. She is an influential journalist. She is somebody who writes for the mainstream media. She is somebody. This book hasn't come out with some like fringe. You know, this has come out with one of the most mainstream presses that you can imagine, with massive praise from establishment figures on the back of it, and all over the place. So, I would suggest that this in itself then leads me to ask further questions about like how we've arrived at this place where somebody who's clearly mental is being valorized by the establishment in the way that she is. Okay, she says to this today, blah, 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 blah. It's like Portney. This is Portney's Complaint, which is a novel I was made to read at university. It's like Portney says when he first visits the country, after a lifetime of being around weak and worrying diaspora types, look at the Jewish children laughing, acting as if they own the place, which they do. I never sought in the Jews what many penny ante fellow Semites seek, Jewish warmth and all that jazz, like poor dumb Mary Jane in Portnoy's Complaint. The only Jewish warmth I was ever interested in came out of a circumcised cock, frankly. Fucking hell. Oh, fucking hell. Jesus Christ. This is what... However bad I thought this book was going to be, it's even worse. Like, it's bizarre. It really is. Fucking hell. Oh, Birchill, you are fucking... I don't like Jewish humor, the film of Woody Allen's, or bagels. I don't think families are the most important thing in the world. I'm not seeking anything from the Jews at all, if truth be told. I'm seeking an absence, a mystery, an unknowable something which happened centuries ago, which resulted in a tribe of desert nomads surviving for four millennia, while every sucker, charlatan, and seducee attempted to eradicate them, to basically build the modern world. A tribe which then imagined itself into triumphant rebirth as a nation, combative and contrary as all get out, after ceaseless centuries of roaming in the wilderness. And there is more than one sort of wilderness. Just how did a desert tribe, apparently not that much different from any other bunch of biblical primitives, come out of a bleak, bullied walkabout as what looks to me very much like the next step in the evolution of mankind? Put simply, the Jews were never given for making the rest of mankind look like monkeys in comparison. Jews were never forgiven for making the rest of mankind look like monkeys in comparison. And ooh, 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 I so did want to be like them. Fucking hell. I have to pause. Sorry, I just have to pause. This is so... this is bizarre. Now, people saying this video will not be online for long would then have to tell me, why is this book published? This book is not. This book is mainstream. I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying anything one way or the other about it, other than pointing out that this exists and this is valorized by the mainstream. This is my point here. I find it profoundly strange that Julie Birchall arrived in this place. So there we go. Let's carry on. Looking back over what I've written here, there is, of course, an elephant in the room, especially in my bedroom. Apart from that playful pachyderm named masturbation, which, hot as hell and determined to keep myself tidy for what lay ahead. I stole that line from Princess Diana. I became a veritable virtuoso at from the age of 12. Sometimes, oh, for fuck's sake. Sometimes giving myself such a good seeing to that I land on the floor beside my bed with a profoundly childish bump and scurry sneakily back under the covers again as my mum calls up the stairs, "Oi, you got a baby elephant up there?" But even more than masturbation, I mean music. Music was the noisiest elephant in the room as I hit adolescence. It's interesting that it's interesting, isn't it, that she has a massive interest in this, and now suddenly we get into like rank degeneracy. Why is this paragraph of rank degeneracy nuzzling up to this philo-Semitism? Questions must be asked here. And hopefully she's about to answer it. But even before the masturbation, I mean music. Music was the noisiest elephant in the room. I hit adolescence. And the one thing I loved as much as the Jews and abusing myself. Sometimes gazing at my posters of Mark Bolan, a Jew, nay, Feld, son of Simeon. Now, I didn't know that Mark Bolan was Jewish. So that's interesting. Didn't know that. I found it hard to know where music ended and masturbation began. And that was the magic of being a teenager in a naughty old nutshell. When you're a kid, a teenager, music is like a dream of sex. It's like, I mean, I was really into music as a kid, and still am into music, and it's never been about masturbation for me, love. So, I mean, press one if you think music and masturbation need to go together, and press two if you think music can just live on its own without the masturbation. But let's just see how many people agree with old Judy here. This is fucking mental, this book. Yes, I don't see a single one. Everybody says two. So you're weird, Julie. Oh, there is a one. Mutty meme. I see you, Mutty meme. I see you. You should write to Julie. You should write to Julie Birchall. When you're a kid, a teenager, music is like a dream of sex. It's like, as my husband Dan says, standing on a really high rooftop for the first time and looking out and seeing all manner of fantastic things you've never, ever dreamed existed. And if the music is good enough, if it touches you hard enough in all the soft places, it makes you feel that you can fly. I started adoring Mark Bolan at the age of 12. Later, when I was a sassy 17-year-old, he would catch my eye in a punk club and smile, and I would look away quickly, as if he could, as if he could have told just by looking at me all the times as a child I came so hard thinking about him. Fucking hell. Fucking hell. This is just, sorry. Spurned by his erstwhile love slave, and to be honest, by the self-consciously cool crowd in general, who probably all masturbated over his image as kids, he mooched around the club alone for a little longer and then left alone, just like in How Soon Is Now, and soon he died a rock star's death, wrapped around a tree in a speeding car. Ah, the fickleness of self-fiddling youth. Now, just to explain what's happening in the literary mode here, Judy Birchall has done something that she thinks is clever, because she mentioned Portnoy from Portnoy's Complaint. And if you've ever read Portnoy's Complaint, it is a novel by a Jewish guy all about masturbating as a teenager and about his kind of furious masturbation when he was an adolescent. And now Birchall has basically is doing her own version of Portnoy's Complaint, only as a woman. Do you see? So there is a bit of like, you could say, well, this is all filth, but it's also kind of like self-consciously literary in a way that may make you know, sophisticated London types titter to themselves for knowing that. It's not clever, by the way. It's not. There's nothing about that makes it clever. It just says that you've read Portnoy's complaint, and so have we. I mean, it just means nothing. So I have nothing but contempt for this passage. But anyway, let us carry on to see where this goes. And if we get to the end of the chapter, maybe we'll do another one. But in the early 70s, from Ride a White Swan in 1971 to 20th Century Boy in 1973, Mark Bolan's the singer from T-Rex, if you don't know. There is nothing I wouldn't have done. Let me just put the entropy chat in there. I keep on forgetting to do that. People did ask earlier. There you go. Entropy chat is now pinned. I can see DOA is in the house. Hope you're enjoying Julie Birchall's memoirs here about her philo-Semitism, which has turned into a chronicle of her masturbating as a teenager. Anyway, she says, but in the early 70s, from Ride a White Swan in 1971 to 20th Century Boy in 1973, there is nothing I wouldn't have done for this doe-eyed, sucky-cheeked, glitter-dusted man-boy. I mean anything. The things I thought up for us to do should we ever have the good fortune to be locked in the lavatory together from Monday to Saturday, just like in the nursery rhyme, make my blood run cold, even now, to countenance. And I've been married 3 times. It's a wonder it wasn't 4 times, as I distinctly recall after reading one of Dennis Wheatley too many times, drawing a risibly inept pentagram on a bit of school graph paper one night when my parents were innocently imbibing at the local hostelry the good intent and solemnly promising my soul to Beelzebub if he fixed it for me to marry Mark B when I came of age. Just think, if I'd smiled back that night at the Vortex, I could be one of your actual damned by now. And I don't mean the rubbish punk group either. Anyway, during these couple of years, I would buy anything with his face on. That included a horrible, boring-looking newspaper-type thing called the New Musical Express, with no colour photos you could properly touch yourself up over, and dirty black ink that came off on one pinkies anyway. The idea of getting ink on one's clitoris was appalling to me at the age of 12. Later, it would seem, not so bad at all. Fuck's sake. Fucking hell. I want to explain again, okay, as I blow my nose. This is not some niche book. This is not a book that was somehow kind of buried away on the fetish aisle or on the kind of extreme literature end of things. This was valorized, published by Random House, championed, and put front and center in our culture, this book. This book where the author pictures herself as a clown on the front, surrounded by Jewish people, talks about how she wishes she was Jewish, and then writes a chapter about how she furiously masturbated over the face of a Jew when she was young. You know, this is pretty close to what passes for our mainstream culture today. And questions have to be asked as, why? Why is this book so front and center? And should that be the case? should this book have been as relentlessly promoted as it was in 2014? Anyway, let's continue. I was beyond delighted to find a 3-part interview with him by someone called Nick Logan, which contained swearing, and one's masturbatory idol doesn't get any better. I wondered as I abused myself for the nth time. A word about the enemy here. It was selling more than 300 copies a week back then and had the unmistakable rough beast swagger of a magazine whose time has come. Now it sells less than 24,000 and looks like some free sheet that you'd see left undefiled on the bus But in 1972, somehow, for reasons, it felt itself and did not seem to understand. It had been around since 1952, and quite recently was wetting its collective necks at the sight of Helen Shapiro sharing a joke with Joe Loss. It had become a sort of world service of hip, and should remain so until the 1980s, when the new glossies prized the baton of the zeitgeist from its pale, clammy hand. Can I just say, by the way, that I despise this. As the author of Foundations of Writing, and as someone who really cares about the craft of writing, it's very clear to me that Judy Burchill comes from this world of music journalism. Music journalism is the epicenter of bad writing. I hate her style. I hate this kind of, there's something about this piling up of shitty adjectives and just her whole manner of writing is horrible to me. So, if you do Foundations of Writing and come out writing like this, I'll give you a refund. I'll tell you that much. Decades later, I met a boy from New Zealand, pleasingly named David Cohen. And he expressed the way most enemy readers who live beyond the exciting burgs of London and New York felt. Can you imagine being 15 and just sitting on this rock at the end of the world? And then every week this paper arrives and you actually feel part of the world for once. Happily, David C. got back in touch with me through the wonder of Facebook while I was writing this. And I asked him to elaborate further. He said the following, the last bit of which is a testimony to my extreme Zionism, even in my SWP late teens. The boy looked at Johnny, having been published in 1978. Regarding the enemy, it's hard to overstate what a cultural staple this was for younger New Zealanders in the 1970s and 80s. I mean, I remember the enemy when I was a kid. It was the enemy were, when I was a teenager in the 90s, they were trying to reorientate themselves as a kind of Brit pop outfit. But I always thought enemy had kind of like, it was already past its time when I was a teenager, and you could tell that it wasn't really where it was at, in my opinion. But it had this reputation as being once a bastion of cool when I was a teenager. So maybe its high point was the early 80s there, or the 70s, when Judy was around. She says, it's hard to overstate what a cultural staple this was for younger New Zealanders in the 1970s and 80s. It was very expensive in those days, so any British publication typically took upon up to 4 months to arrive in the Antipodes. And of course, given how quickly new trends were being discovered and then ditched by the paper's writers, it often happened that the smart set who read it would be latching on to acts who had been long consigned to the rubbish bin back in the UK. So the cultural lag was like 4 or 5 months behind in New Zealand. So you had this kind of long echo thing going on in the Antipodes, in, for example, the cases of Joy Division, The Specials, The Smiths, and all the rest. But that didn't stop almost everyone else here lapping it up. And of course, in the case of young rock crits, completely aping the style. Yeah, I mean, the enemy style is cancer. I'll just put it out there. The style of enemy criticism is cancer, and it should be obliterated. I mean, I cannot wait for this generation of writers, the Julie Burchills and this fucking David Cohen or whoever. I cannot wait for them to go. But unfortunately, they've passed it on. They've passed on that style to the Pitchfork types, which also has a cancerous, I hate that style. And I mean, what do they teach in journalism school? What do they even teach these people? Hold on. Ugh. What, I mean, what is enemy style like, you know? They love sentences like, great new album. It's like Bob Dylan meets Leonard Cohen. What the fuck does that sentence mean? You know, you see that all the time. You see that sort of thing all the time. And it's like, just fuck off. Let's carry on. I was a terrible offender in this respect, so much so that I can't bear to look at anything I wrote back about music in my late teens and early 20s because it was so horribly derivative of the same. What do you want about Julie? You still write in the same way now. Nonetheless, the culture here would have been much different here without it. I remember really enjoying your writing, in particular because the voice was... This is Nick Cohen saying that, not Julie. That's right. I remember really enjoying your writing in particular because the voice was so distinctive, no derivation there. And for the fact that it was a woman working in such an overwhelmingly testosterone-soaked organ. But to be totally honest, what got me the most was line 4 of the dedications in The Boy Looked at Johnny, which, as a somewhat alienated 17-year-old, I thought was just stunning, and all the more for the publishers disassociating themselves from it. That took courage. And I think, I hope, in some way it inspired me much more than any of those dead reviews from NME in my later work. Line 4 of the dedication in The Boy Looked at Johnny was to no less than Menachem Begin, the great Israeli prime minister, whose Ergun liberation movement was the most militant in its actions against British rule in Palestine, a name for Judea, I was to discover imposed by the Roman conquerors. The co-author Tony Parsons and I found it amazing and amusing in equal parts as to how the Jewish-owned left-wing Pluto Press could actually go so far as dissociating themselves from a dedication, which was sure by its nature so personal that such an action was superfluous, to say the least. What's this boy calls Johnny? Is this some... The Boy Called John. Is this some book by Julie Birchall? Boy Called John. What is this book that they're going about? We should probably find out. What's this book called? Boy Looked at Johnny. Let's have a look. Is this a Julie Birchall novel? That would make sense. Boy Looked at Johnny. The Obituary of Rock and Roll by Julie Birchall, published in 1987. The Boy Looked at Johnny. Here we go. Let me just share this so you know what we're talking about here. this is The Boy Looked at Johnny. You can see it's associated with like Sex Pistols. We looked at Johnny Rotten earlier in an earlier Deeper Store, if you recall. So there we are. The Boy Looked at Johnny. The Obituary of Rock and Roll by Julie Birchall and Tony Parsons. Tony Parsons, he was another of these kind of rock dudes. There he is. Tony Parsons is often also a kind of talking head on many kind of mainstream media documentaries and things like that. Then we'll get back then to Birchall's book. Only being young brats of the working class blood royal, this probably wasn't the way we expressed our contemptuous incredulity to each other at the time. Prats was probably nearer our considered opinion, certainly no further from the truth. Interestingly, the other quarter from which the most objection came to our dear little dedication was from a fellow working class music hack, Gary Bushell of Sounds. Now, Gary Bushell is also a rent-a-gob who you'll find, I think he wrote for The Sun for many years. Let me just show you a picture of Gary Bushell. He's a kind of squashed-faced kind of vermin of a man as well. I really hate these people. I really do. But yeah, here is Gary Bushell, who is often also on the same sorts of shows that you find Tony Parsons and Judy Burchell on. Okay. So let's carry on. The other objection came from Gary Bushell of Sound. Even writing that last bit of the sentence makes me wince, and I'm not exactly sensitive. It's just so horrid. You know, you grow up reading Dottie Parker and Ozzy Wilde, and you never dream that one day you're going to be using exactly the same exquisite tongue in which to grimly etch the words Gary Bushell of Sounds. Old Bacon Bonce, with his grotty wife fronts, one imagines with a shudder, into a right old twist over it, banging on about Zionist war criminals and what have you. Bushell is most remembered these days for cultivating the Oi Bands, a gaggle of outfits which arrived as the afterbirth of punk, so very unsophisticated that they even made Sham 69 look like the Dave Brubeck Quartet, which eventually brought forth luscious fruit in the blessed year of 1981 in the form of Strength Through Oi compilation album under the auspices of Bacon Bonce himself. This is one of the things that the Enemy style was known for, by the way, this endless fucking run-on sentence, you know, the bunching up of adjectives behind a noun that never fucking... Sorry, people. Sorry, can you hear me now? Can you hear me? No. I was gesticulating wildly as I was talking, and I just happened to hit my microphone, and it caused it to come undone. Sorry, can you hear me now? You can hear me. Okay. So let me just read that last bit again. Anyway, back to the past and the past glories of the Enemy in particular. Long after Mark Bolan had fallen out of favor with my childish fist, fucking disgusting, I continued to cleave to my Enemy as fiercely as a suicidal baby to a poison rattle. And as I was ranting into the mic while it was muted, I was saying, there is no excuse to write, like, that is a disgusting sentence. Every part of that sentence is disgusting. The childish fist part is disgusting. The suicidal baby image is disgusting, and the poison rattle is disgusting. There's just no excuse for that sentence. So, I really find that gross. Really find it gross. I don't know when exactly my mic cut out. I was in the middle of a rant about sentences that, you know, adjectives that pile up without a noun finally arriving. And I think as I gesticulated saying that, it knocked my mic. So there we go. But this is just a disgusting way of writing. It really is. All around me, the glowing normality of my friends and family showed me how happy and straightforward life could be. I mean, you got the fucking option of living with normality around you, Julie, before you decided to destroy the culture all around us, so that now any normal person is surrounded by Judy Burchells. That, you know, now a 13-year-old in a school now will be surrounded by Judy Birchalls, and they all made to be feel they all made to be feel abnormal because they're not like you. That's what's happened. You are responsible, Julie. Anyway, let's carry on. She says, if only one expected small pleasures, and I wanted none of it. If I'd had to put into words, I would have said in my yokelish tilt that I wanted to be a poetry writing junkie dying of consumption in an attic. Thank you very much. And could I please be a lesbian too while you're at it, Santa? So she doesn't just want to be Jewish. She wants to be a lesbian and a junkie dying in an attic as well. The NME writers, well, Charles Shaw Murray and Nick Kent, anyway, made my school girlish head swim with the lush, loosh lives that they appeared to lead. Years later, I discovered CSM to be a henpecked husband straight out of a sitcom, and Nick Kent to be so half-witted that on regularly bumping into a hat stand on entering the NME office, he apologized to it. But anyway, and they didn't even have to play... And they didn't even have to play a sodding musical instrument in order to get these lives. I knew from various besotted English teachers that I had a way with words. Might I somehow use those words to get away? I wish those fucking English teachers had taught you how to write, Julie. That's my honest opinion. As somebody who has taught English at the highest level, I would recommend you to go back and learn how to write again, because honestly, this book is making me angry for its prose style alone. I was also querying another matter at this time. Could one actually make oneself a lesbian by having the hots for oneself too frequently? I was once a regular little girl, kissing boys behind the school library shelves, never anything as sordid as bike sheds for ever bookish little me, and masturbating over caterwauling love totems. But I seem increasingly interested in girls as I edged through my teens. I had an inkling that it might have been sheer self-preservation as I became of an age where I might conceivably conceive and thus up the ante of getting struck in Nowheresville on Southern Forever. I shied away from the source of such semen-spread shackledom. So she sees the prospect of family life as being ultimately constraining. She doesn't want that. So just to explain this in normal lay English, Julie Birchall so feared having a family that she was trying to will herself to become a lesbian to get away from it. Or is it simply that I fancied myself so often in my full-length junior princess dressing table mirror of a morning that I had gone and turned myself irretrievably queer? All that masturbation, and it had been a girl's hand doing it. Fucking hell. Woo. Spiteful mutant. I mean, this is something. Really is something. When my mother made coy comments about boys, I wanted to strike her. Maybe this lesbohood was my punishment for upsetting her whenever she attempted to give me a goodnight kiss. Father, has it ever occurred to you that mother may have lesbian tendencies? I would pipe pompously, pushing her away. When I thought of the... It's kind of interesting that it's this woman who kind of wants to be Jewish. Find it really odd. When I thought of the ark animals going in two by two, it made me want to retch. What if they had absolutely nothing in common? The unutterable vulgarity of the whole setup made me wince. Anyway, like a million other pale teenage self-abusers, I saw that photo of Patti Smith from the cover of Horses album, and I was barely able to sit down for a week. Oh, for fuck's sake. If you want to know what Judy was masturbating over, let's have a look at Patti Smith's Horses again. So that you too can pretend, you know, if you're a female in my audience, you too can try to will yourself to become a lesbian. Talk about Ashes of Civilization. It's a great album, by the way. It's a really good album, but there you go. this is what Julie Birchall is talking about there. So, yeah, let's carry on. Tell you what, this is whatever I thought this was going to be. It's blown even my expectations of it. This book so far, like another million pale teenage self-abusers. I saw that photo of Patti Smith from the cover of Horses, and I could barely sit down for a week. I buy it, don't get it, but I love it anyway. Smith would turn out to be your archetypal, beautiful but dumb showbiz kid, saying things like, there's a real lot of inspiration going on between the murder and his victim, and slagging off Israel like a thing possessed. But for now, that's her real crime. Her real crime was slagging off Israel, of course. But for now, my bed was on fire five times a night, and not just because of the drought. Sticky with ambition and lust, I tossed and turned in my vaginal bed all night long, but especially tossed. In the long, hot summer of July 1976, they prayed for rain in the churches of the West Country. So did I. A flood, something, anything to sweep me clean away from this lovely place and my wonderful parents into a fetid embrace of unkind strangers. In Uganda, at the Entebbe airport, Palestinian and German hijackers of all the countries of the world and all of the terrorists of the world, Palestinians had to hook up with Germans to kill Jews. Separated Jewish and non-Jewish passengers on the Air France aeroplane, they have been hijacked as they chose who will die first. Was it back, or did it really never end? I completed my O-levels and agreed to go back and do my A-levels. And that paragraph there just kind of whacked in, apropos of nothing. I completed my O-levels and agreed to go back and do my A-levels in September. Anything would be better than getting a job in the sodding biscuit factory and admitting defeat. She was living in Trumpton and she could have gone and worked at the biscuit factory, but instead she's doing this fucking degeneracy. I read that piece by the man who passed for Jewish in Rolling Stone magazine, pale with envy. I also turned 17. WTF, I lay on the grass in the back garden, sulking about how my life was over before it begun, until a bunch of bastard ants, who were obviously in league with my mother, made me jump up from my unwholesome idling and headed straight into the house to have another quick abuse of myself over the sleeve of Horses. As luck would have it, after checking that the parents were otherwise employed. Now that I was 17, masturbation felt sad, whereas it had been the most fun I'd ever have. Once it had made me feel free, but now it made me feel like a dirty jailer. If I met you, I could get away from here, I told the impassive woman whose image I had propped up on the pillow. I know I could get away if I met you and never come back. Then a miracle happened in black and white. For 2 weeks in July, ignobly jostled by the ads for no time wasters and tie-dye shirt wasters, and ad runs in the enemy. Attention, hip young gunslingers. The enemy has a vacancy for a staff writer. Previous experience in either journalism or music business is not essential, but a good knowledge of rock and enthusiasm are, together with the ability to write lovely, incisive prose. All applications must be accompanied by a sample 500 to 600 word review of any album of the applicant's choice. So here we go. Here's Julie's big chance to make it into the world of hip degeneracy. Does she make it? Let's see, readers. I can do that, I thought. I had a typewriter. How's your typing coming on? My mum was wont to ask, poking her head round the door of the back room where I furiously pounded out fantasies of sex and revenge. I'm writing, Mum, not typing, I hissed for the nth time, but I decided that I was going to milk my youth for all it was worth. I hand-wrote my Horses review on paper torn jaggedly from a schoolbook. I shook my fountain pen over the finished effort for that extra inky-fingered teenage scamp effect. I was stage-managing myself even then, even when the nearest I'd been to a stage was my star turn as the sailor doll in the Mixed Juniors panto way back before I grew tits and ambition. There were more than 15,000 applicants for that job, of which, of course, I didn't know at the time. But even if I had known there had been a million, I would still have been sure of getting it. I laughed at my mum's mates who could feel things in their water. But from the moment I posted that envelope to the New Musical Express, Kingsreach Tower, Stamford Street, London, SE1, into the postbox at the top of my street, it was my street no longer. I became like an astronaut in one of those sleeping chambers, frozen, waiting for life to begin. To all intents and purposes, I seemed the same. I cheeked my mum. I swore at the dog. I abused myself. But really, I was in a trance state, treading water and biding my time. Solemnity. Hold on a minute. Solemnly contemplating the helter-skelter I had been wanting to throw myself down, headfirst, ever since I heard the word London. Of course she has to end up in London. Of course she does. 3 weeks into my A-levels in September, I got the job. Oh, shit. I got the job. I remember pretending Jewish man. Could I become my own Frankenstein and his creation too? Yes, I could. I dyed my hair black. I shivered with pleasure at my own reflection. I abused myself extra that night. Nothing could stop me. I was about to abandon speech, that chunky, clunky second language. I had come to loathe and embrace my mother tongue, writing, and better yet, I would do it as a Jew. For me, at least, the drought was over. Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. For someone as obsessed with honesty, I'm just putting that in because I'm imagining that's what she was. The prose was building up to a climax as she masturbated to horses, you see, and that's why I imagine that that was about to come in. So there we have it. For someone as obsessed with honesty as I have become, it never fails to shock me that I went into my job at the enemy living not just one lie, but two. For starters, I said I loved punk music. Ha, I was a punk of convenience from the start, realizing instinctively that they were looking for some hot young blood to wet nurse them, as it were, through the upcoming and somewhat problematic to a bunch of wet middle-class hippies, that is, punk movement. The only music that existed for me was black music, and punk was just about the whitest, most sexless, and joyous sound I'd ever heard. But I threw away my dancing shoes and grabbed the safety pins PDQ, and thus began my short career as a hypocrite. But when you're a super bright working class girl who knows that following one's mater into a cupboard box factory is definitely not quite what one is dreaming of, you don't have the luxury of taking decisions at leisure. Unlike the dreary, late-blooming offspring of the middle class, you don't faff away your fruit salad chew days, pissing around with uni and gap years and sabbaticals until your mid-20s. You see a ladder climbing down from the copter, and you climb. It's a pity they didn't fuck you, throw you off the helicopter, I tell you. I remember many a night coming home to my scuzzy bedsit in my dear, how divinely amusing, crouch end, my ears ringing with the latest vile white trash cacophony, peeling off my dumbass punk gear and dancing round the room in my scanties to the cleansing balm of the Isley Brothers Forever Gold on my little red dancette. Free at last of that rotten white racket. Free at last. Fortunately, punk would be over within 2 years. The only thing good about it, in my opinion. Even more deviously, I have presented myself as a Jew, getting around my yokel, piping, and resolutely rural place surname by claiming that my mother was a Polish Jewess called Elizabetha Griespan. I'm actually cringing as I write this for the first time. During my library forays into Jewish history, I had been very taken with a photograph of a 17-year-old Herschel Grinspan. He was a beautiful young refugee from Poland who, in the striking black and white photographs of him at the time of his notoriety, could have been mistaken for a neurotic boy outsider of the crooning or modeling mode. but was in fact famous for the rather more substantial achievement of assassinating the German diplomat Ernst von Rath on the 9th of November 1938 in Paris, providing the Nazis with a pretext for Kristallnacht, the pogrom of the 10th and 11th of November, which saw Jewish homes, synagogues, shops and businesses destroyed across Germany. In 1944, Sir Michael Tippett's On Otario About Him, A Child of Our Time, would first be performed. And 32 years later, I would tell any of my enemy colleagues who asked that he was my mother's cousin. They say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, and that was certainly true in my case. It makes me laugh to look back at it now. True, I dyed my hair black and had a big nose, but with my Somerset twang, I was a very strange Jew indeed. All I lacked was a bit of straw sticking out of my mouth and the perfume of muck spreading on my mitts. So far as I could make out, there were two real Jews at the NME. And though neither of them had Jewish names, Murray and Farron, I knew by now that, incredibly, many Jews were uncomfortable with the bounteous blessing of their ethnicity. Still, I was amazed that they didn't rumble me. They apparently were so alienated from their own roots. I tutted to myself that they had no Judah whatsoever. I remember thinking shocked, boy, Jews can be dumb too. It's weird when you meet your first dumb Jew, like meeting a gay man who can't dance. I've never gotten used to it right to this day. I mean, isn't there something really remarkable about this passage here where she says, how can Jewish people be so alienated from their own roots? Alienated from their own roots. The irony. Do you think she's aware of the irony? Is it possible that she's not aware of the irony? Is it possible that she's aware of the irony? So, let's carry on. Oh, that's it. Should I do any more? I mean, that was fascinating, wasn't it? That was absolutely fascinating. Let's now look at the front cover again. I just find this book remarkable. I really do. My coffee's gone cold. I could either just finish the stream and do super chats now, or we could do a bit more. There's Julie, look. Clown. This is a remarkable book. I'm kind of into it, though, you know. I kind of want to read more. It's made me want to read more about this fucking filthy woman. Here's all her other books, look. She wrote a book on Beckham. Yes. I mean, she is truly a subversive, this woman. Truly a cultural subversive. Shall we do one more? Meet the Perverts, Off My Face, In the Promised Land, The New Jews, Too Cool for School, Unchosen. People are saying it's hate porn. Nah, let's figure out. Somebody's saying read page 88. let's see where this goes. Shall we just have a look at the end of the book and have a look at the concluding paragraph to see what her this is remarkable, because you kind of get an insider look at the look at this and try to understand the not just the psychology of this woman, but like bits of the bits of this. I might come back to this, but I might do another stream on this because I just find it so fascinating. I bet there's a lot worse material in this book that I didn't look at. Let me see if I can get to the end. Ah, I can't bother to anymore. Let's just have a look at entropy and get out of here. So, Years the Eunuch says, deepest lore on the Fallout games could be amazing. I volunteer to be your co-host for that miniseries. I know a lot and can prepare a lovely section on the art sources, etc., that inspire the setting. Unfortunately, I only ever played New Vegas. I played a little bit of Fallout 3, I seem to recall, and Fallout 2, which was the isometric one. Years the Eunuch says, so Birchill is like Rachel Dolezal, but identifies as rich and powerful instead of African. Yes, but interestingly, if you notice, she was anti-white in her music tastes. She saw punk as being white, had to pretend to like it, and secretly like black music instead. I mean, I don't know if that's part of LARPing as being Jewish or not, but that's her own words, not mine. King Cribble says, a deepest lore on football when? I would especially be interested in Arsenal. I find the metaphysics of Arsenal Wenger at the club reminiscent of Chairman Mao for China, especially given that Mikel Arteta, the latest manager, has a tall image of him emblazoned on the main training ground wall. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I see Arsene Wenger as a kind of leftist in football terms too, but not for the kind of hero worship of him around Arsenal, which is understandable, but more for his the fact that he's an ideologue for a certain vision of the game. He's like the game must be played one way and one way only, and I disagree with that. I'm much more into the pragmatics of the Giovanni Trapattoni or Capello or Mourinho or any other proper football manager. So I do see Wenger as a kind of a zealous and a kind of ideologue. Yes. Years the Eunuch says, this woman's writing is exactly the kind of putrid filth I'd expect from an agent of Moloch. I mean, she basically said, I love masturbating over Mark Boland's face so much, I pray to Satan and Beelzebub. That was her own words. Absolutely vile. This woman is peak subversive, an anti-white devil of the highest order. Yeah, and I think she'd be proud of that. I don't think that she would shy away from saying that that is who she is. And she, you know, she embraces it. She embraces the demon within, if you want. Coca-Cola says, so she's female, but not Jay, and wants to be a Jay. She must be the bizarro Weininger. Yeah, she's almost like the if Otto Weininger could make like a reverse negative mirror image of himself, it would come out with Judy Birchill. Otto Weininger, of course, hated both women and this group, despite being a Jewish himself. So, yes, let me have a look at Super Chats. Yeah, she would absolutely be proud of it. I have no doubt of that whatsoever. This has been an interesting stream, I think. Very interesting. More revealing than anything else, I think. Let's see what else. Cringe Walker says, I hope D is making sound bites about your blind undying love of Israel. Cringe Walker, I mean, I am technically a Zionist, incidentally, Cringe Walker. In so much as I believe it's important for everybody to have their own homeland. And, I think it's like right that they should have their own homelands and go to it. Cringe Walker says warmth. And then a little winky face. Death by Cognitive Dissonance says, I just want to put Judy Birchill into a soundproof room with Years of the Eunuch, lock the door until Years is finished. And Death by Cognitive Dissonance says, reading this has worsened your conditioning. Eh? Yeah, you can say that again. So I felt myself getting iller and iller reading this absolute filth. And that's it. Hopefully everybody enjoyed this first edition of Deepest Lore on the Monday. It's a new home for Deepest Lore. I can't see the chat now. You need to find it again. But yes, we'll be back next week. Unpopular Opinions is back tomorrow night, 9 p.m. and then Cigar Stream is 9 p.m. or Wednesday night. This is the new schedule, and if I can get my nose unblocked for long enough, I might make a new channel intro with a new schedule on it. I just don't want to make it while I've got this cold, because it will be there forever and be the first thing anybody lands on. So I need to get my voice sorted before I do that. All right. Bye, everyone. Now get out.